Demonstrations in Tehran started with sellers in the main bazaar leaving their market stalls to protest the government.
The crisis is so immediate and so pressing and urgent for the small business people that they're willing to risk their lives coming to the streets.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, why they are protesting and what could happen as a result. Also, a coal mining region in Germany has cut air pollution, but there is still a long way to go.
The sky turned blue again, and I think many people just thought the problem is solved.
Plus, what cannons from the Caribbean are doing in upstate New York.
And how Danes ring in the new year.
We get up on the chairs, tables,
sofa.
The symbolism of furniture and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in.
Today is the third straight day of protests in the capital of Iran. They're spurred on by the steep depreciation of the country's currency, the rial. Its value has fallen so dramatically that people are struggling to buy basic goods.
It is the latest in a long string of crises Iranians have weathered this year. Now it seems frustration with the government has passed a threshold. Hadi Gaemi is executive director of the Center for Human Rights in Iran. When we reached him earlier today in New York, he started by describing the scale of the protests happening now.
They are right now spontaneously breaking out throughout the country. It began within the vicinity of the traditional business center of the city, the bazaar. And it has been growing outward from that area. Now, today, we're getting reports that the northern Tehran neighborhoods, which are usually centers of protest, also seeing people coming out. And it's not just restricted to Tehran. It actually, in several large and small cities, has been going on and seems to be growing on its third day, but primarily began around the business districts by shop owners and small business people.
I mean, that's a really important bazaar, the one in Tehran you were just talking about. What does it say that shopkeepers are leaving their stalls, closing them up, and going into the streets?
Well, it is the heartbeat of the country's economy. The bazaar traditionally for centuries has played that role. And they usually also have been somewhat conservative and open to negotiations with government to address their grievances. But this tells me that the crisis is so immediate and so pressing and urgent for these business people, small business people, that they're willing to risk their lives coming to the streets and confronting the government forces head on, and that is causing other parts of the city also to rise up.
What are the protesters saying, Hadi? What are their demands?
The very immediate spark of the protests was the collapse of the Iranian currency, the fact that everybody waking up every day and finding the dollar rate has gone up yet more. And the point we have to understand is that everybody's livelihood in that country depends on the price of the dollar. The country's economy is extremely dependent on that currency. So the immediate spark was economic protests, but very quickly, just like in 2022, when we saw women leading protests that went beyond women's rights and became political immediately, we're seeing the same trend. Now they are anti-government protests, basically, where the economy is one of the issues. But at the core of it is the fact that people don't see any representation or their interests reflected in the regime and the government's policies.
Yeah, apparently Iran's state-sanctioned media have focused on the currency devaluation as a root cause of the protest, but I suspect that they're focusing on that so they don't have to cover other causes of people's anger.
Precisely. But what we're hearing and seeing from our local sources is that chanting and the protest messages are all political right now and against the regime.
I mean, this is a regime well known for punishing dissent. How risky is it for all these people to take to the streets like this?
They are risking their lives. They have a very recent memory of 2022 when major uprisings took place throughout the country, led by young women and the youth primarily, but it spread throughout the country. And government forces were very brutal. They murdered over 500 people in cold blood, and they detained over 30,000 people, exercised torture and sexual violence against them in prisons. So people are risking everything. But we got to understand that at some point, society reaches a point where it is experiencing so much despair and lack of hope or any glimmer of improvements that it has no other choice but to put its own livelihood and life on the table and come out and protest.
Hadi, is it surprising to hear President Pezeshkian say to his interior minister, listen to the demands of the protesters?
Not at all. It may be the only card they have left to try. In previous times, they have never really shown any openness, especially in the first days of protest, any openness to the demands of the protesters, and have always used hard violence as their immediate response. I think they know that right now any killing or images of violence can expand and help the protesters bring out more protesters.
I'm also curious to know what your thoughts are. This report from the Norway-based Iran Human Rights Organization, Iran Human Rights Group, finding that nearly double the number of executions had taken place in 2025 up until December. Is that something you're watching as these protests continue there?
Absolutely. This has been on our radar. I mean, I have personally monitored the executions on a daily basis for over 20 years and have never seen this. This has been an unprecedented year where we wake up and we have news from inside prisons throughout the country. A day doesn't go by that several executions don't take place. So those numbers are very accurate. They're probably underreported since none of us are present in the country to do a count, or the regime doesn't provide any accountability. It's been in their playbook for 40 years, but I think it's not going to work anymore, because when people have no prospects of a better future, those executions are even going to make them more angry.
So what options does the regime in Iran have to get the situation that seems to be slipping away from them under control? Like, how far would they go right now?
I think we have seen that their thinking in Syria during the Syria civil war. We shouldn't forget that Bashar al-Assad basically subcontracted Iranian intelligence and revolutionary guards after the peaceful uprising in 2011 to define its policy toward the protesters. And we saw the outcome of that was horrible crimes against civilian population. I think the hardliners in Iran are ready to go down that path. The question is, how much will the rank and file follow? Because after all, in Syria, they were disconnected from the local population. Here, they are part of the local population. And eventually, the question is, can the real power centers in Iran, and by that I mean people who control massive economic wealth of the country, as well as the armed forces, decide that the current system has to be changed so they can keep their power? I would not rule out the possibility of the supreme leader disappearing from the scene, and somewhat what some in the Iranian regime refer to as the Saudi model, where you change domestic policy toward the population to make them happier with the regime, but you keep total economic and political power to yourself and even become more violent against dissent. That may be their only way out. The question is, are they capable of it, and will the people buy into such a Saudi model?
I mean, the evidence suggests that the writing on the wall feels very stark right now, and that's certainly underscored by what you've been telling us. Is 2026 the year that the Islamic Revolution falls apart?
I do not want to make that prediction, because we know that, especially in the diaspora, this claim has been made over and over for many years. I think the regime is still pretty strong. The real question is, will we see a credible political alternative to the regime to make the vast majority of dissatisfied people to come to support it and want the regime to go? As much as the regime is brittle and fragile, it does have the fortune of not having a powerful political opposition facing it. in an organized way. So the regime may crack, but it will all depend on alternative political scenario offering itself to the Iranian population.
Well, let me just follow up there with one final question. What about the people of Iran? What are the possible paths forward for them, aside from protesting in the street?
I'm afraid they don't have much else, and they really, any meaningful change has to happen within the country. So they have to outsmart the intelligence security forces and organize themselves, something the regime has been very sensitive and not allowing to happen in any domain. But eventually the people have to find a way to mount a powerful political movement within the country. And that's what I think some of these protesters are going to start to do.
Hadi Gayemi is executive director of the Center for Human Rights in Iran. We reached him in New York. Later in the show, we'll take a broader look at protest movements across the globe and what's been driving unrest in 2025. Yesterday in Lima, Peru, a gathering of shamans made predictions for 2026. They also made offerings.
Ofrendas, hemos realizado ofrendas para poder tener un año mejor.
Shaman Ana Maria Simeon told the Associated Press that the offerings are meant to bring about a better year, something we here at the show can fully get behind. So we are stocking up on grapes.
There is a New Year's tradition in Spain and Latin America of eating 12 grapes in 12 seconds at midnight. Each grape represents a month of good luck in the coming year. It's now a thing on social media. In one YouTube video, a few friends sit in front of a TV trying to keep up with the timing bells. Turns out 12 grapes in 12 seconds, not so easy.
Yeah, you try talking with 12 grapes in your mouth. There's also a ritual to perform if you want to travel in the year ahead.
At midnight, you grab a suitcase, an empty suitcase, and run outside.
That's the world's Tibisa Isaiah, who is from Venezuela, on their New Year's Eve custom.
I grew up in a working class family and, you know, real travel wasn't really in the cards for us. So our suitcase runs were very aspirational, I would say. But year after year, we did it anyway, out of the door, suitcase in hand, laughing at the idea.
Laughing then, but TV thinks it might have worked.
I've now traveled more than 30 countries and lived in 4. So I guess that suitcase knew what it was doing.
Latin America isn't the only place with rituals meant to usher in a good year. In Denmark,
when the time approaches midnight, we get up on the chairs, the tables, sofa, and we jump into the new year.
Yep, you jump off the furniture at midnight.
It sounds so fun. Einar Jorn Sire Stahlhensen talked to our producer in Copenhagen about it. Apparently, it is considered bad luck to step on the boundary between old and new.
But for me, I don't think of it like that. It's more a fun tradition that we do with our friends and family.
In Ireland, it's all about doors and windows. Here's the world's Orla Barry.
Open the back door of your house just before midnight to let the old year out, so you're brushing away any bad energy from the year. And then on the stroke of midnight, you open the front door to let the new year in.
If you're really committed, Orla says, open all the windows too.
That's only for the very hardy individuals that can tolerate the Irish weather on New Year's Eve.
In North Africa, the Amazin people celebrate the New Year on January 12th with big bonfires and a feast where you are supposed to leave the table totally stuffed to bring a year of abundance.
One dish on the table is a porridge. The host places the pit of a date somewhere in it, and people scrape the bowl with their spoons looking for the pit. It brings extra luck to whoever gets it. So if you miss out this week, there is one more chance.
But Marco, there is one thing you should try to avoid eating tomorrow.
Yeah, what's that?
Fish, because if you do, then your luck will swim away, at least according to Hungarians.
All right, I'll keep that in mind. All right, only red meat tomorrow.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It is almost time to celebrate the semi-quincentennial, which I and maybe you have just now learned means the U.S. is halfway to being 500 years old. In other words, the country's 250th birthday. It will be a big deal in 2026, with events commemorating the American Revolution at significant sites all along the East Coast, including Fort Ticonderoga, that's in upstate New York. It's home to the largest private collection of 18th century artillery in the Western Hemisphere. As reporter Amy Bracken explains, the cannons have traveled a ways to get there.
Fort Ticonderoga sits atop a hill in New York's Adirondack Park. The limestone structure was built by the French and then captured by the British and then the Americans. Crowds come in the winter to commemorate the 1775 so-called Noble Train. That's when Colonel Henry Knox and his men hauled 59 cannons hundreds of miles from here to Boston to help drive out the British. Before the trip, interpreters clean and test the weapons.
All right, Mr. Knox, do you want to take these?
What, sir?
Very well.
And load them onto ox carts.
All right, Sergeant Major Brown, would you bring us a wagon, please?
But visitors usually don't know the story behind the more than 100 cannons that are here today. Some of the original artillery here was long ago moved, like the 59 weapons that went to Boston, and the rest was largely salvaged for scrap iron.
There were no cannon here.
That's Matthew Cagle, Fort Ticonderoga's curator. Before the fort was reconstructed, the embrasures, the holes where the cannons had been, were empty. To explain the collection today, a map titled "Where Did Our Cannon Come From?" was placed on the wall of an exhibit room in the fort. There are some pins in the U.S., France, and England, and then a circle of arrows around the Caribbean Sea. That's the route of the 1930 expedition of H. Germain Slocum, who was hired by the man who owned the site to amass cannons for the restored fort.
It is a peculiar, you know, almost kind of Indiana Jones type adventurer from that era.
Cagle came to the fort 11 years ago and began researching its artillery, and inevitably H. Germain Slocum. He found that the man's mission was clear enough to earn him nicknames like Gunman and Señor Guns.
He finds a pilot in Miami, I think it is, to fly him around, and then takes a tramp steamer along the north coast of South America and through the Antilles, stopping at all these different places.
In his so-called cannon hunting expeditions, Slocum procured scores of weapons from Panama, Nicaragua, Curaçao, St. Kitts, St. Eustatius, the Dominican Republic, and more than anywhere, Haiti. Many of these small countries were full of cannons left behind by Europeans. And Slocum worked to convince leaders in those countries to hand over their weapons. Almost all of them were donated. See, he was an ex-military officer from a prominent military family at a time when the U.S. military had a strong presence around the region. In Haiti, Slocum flew low over the massive fortress, La Citadel, before returning on foot to see what he could haul out.
Oh, okay. But, it says it's being recorded.
Yeah.
Okay.
I called Marlene Doubt to get her thoughts on Slocum's cannon hunting trips. Doubt is a historian of Haiti, including its Revolutionary War. At the time of Slocum's first visit, Haiti was in its 15th year of a U.S. military occupation, ostensibly to stabilize the country. But Doubt says Slocum carrying off cannons in broad daylight elicited a response.
Haitian people did witness this and were kind of like, what are you doing? You can't take these things. And they were sort of like, yes, we have permission from the government, which is, you know, an iffy thing anyway, because it's during the U.S. occupation and all of these heads of state are being installed by the U.S. So naturally, they're going to kind of, I guess, let the United States sort of have full run of the country.
Slocum also made a case to heads of state in Haiti and elsewhere that Fort Ticonderoga was to be a museum of liberty, celebrating independent struggles of peoples across Latin America. And he said there would be a plaque next to every cannon explaining its historical significance. And at first, Cagle says at least some of Slocum's promises about the cannons were kept.
Going back to the 1930s and 40s, there were signs up, and we have them in photographs at the museum, say, you know, donated by the government of the Republic of Haiti, or donated by, you know, so-and-so, all these different nations.
But the wooden plaques have since decayed and weren't replaced. And information about the cannons disappeared along with them, since most of the weapons weren't cataloged until the late 1990s, because they were there as set dressing, as Cagle says, not as museum pieces with their own value. And so, for years, Cagle has been trying to make good on Slocum's promise, however disingenuous, and figure out and share the history behind each cannon. The semi-quincentennial might provide an opportunity to present the American Revolution in a more global way, Cagle says.
So that Fort Ticonderoga is not just this iconic historic site for Americans and American history, but also represents something much bigger.
What makes this moment?
Back to the noble train reenactment.
250 years ago.
Once the carts have been loaded with cannons, these ones are reproductions, Henry Knox and his men start the journey to Boston, passing through downtown Ticonderoga, where a crowd has gathered. Among the history buffs following along are two siblings from an hour and a half south of here.
We've been big noble artillery train fans for a long time.
Both were surprised to learn that the cannons at the fort are largely from Latin America.
I love learning that something has more history to it than just the part of history that it was initially famous for.
That's Clinton Green. His sister Sharon also wanted to learn more.
It's absolutely important to talk about where an artifact is coming from, and especially if you're going to talk about a cannon coming from somewhere like Haiti. They have a huge colonial history, and they had their own independence movement, and all of the history of the Caribbean and the New World and the Atlantic are all tied together.
It's as if Sharon's been talking to Marlene Doubt. The Haiti historian says she sees an opportunity to tell the story of how countries in the Americas went from cooperating in struggles for independence to a situation in the 1900s of the U.S. pilfering from and occupying its neighbors.
Because I think there's a cautionary tale there, too. And so telling the story in a way that is true to all of that, I think it should be, and I hope it will be possible, especially it seems like Fort Ticonderoga would be a perfect site to do that.
But I thank you all so much for joining us today.
It's a site that couldn't feel farther from Haiti, Nicaragua, or Panama. But for the history fans who come here, there will be something new to learn about cannons from all over.
Onward to Boston!
For The World, I'm Amy Bracken, Ticonderoga, New York.
Here at The World, we are also getting ready to celebrate a birthday. We are about to turn 30, as in 30 years on the air. Tune in this Thursday for a celebration of the show and a journey into the archives.
And in the remaining last day of 2025, we want to know what you think about this show. What does The World mean to you? Head to our website, theworld.org, and click on the link in the banner. Your notes will propel us into 2026, and we might share your comment on the air. Again, that's theworld.org, and thank you as always for listening and writing.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. One of the striking developments of 2025 has been the growing number of countries where young people have taken to the streets to demand change. Demonstrations in Nepal and Madagascar lasted for weeks and toppled governments. Protests also surged in Morocco, Kenya, and Indonesia. They've been loosely grouped together as Gen Z protests. When protest hit in Madagascar this fall, we asked Jude Moore at the Center for Global Development about the connections between the different movements.
They may not be talking, that there's no continental or regional association of Gen Zs that are exchanging notes, but they're so chronically online and so digitally connected, they may as well be talking to each other.
As the year draws to a close, we asked Daron Acemoglu to look back at the phenomenon with us. He's an economist at MIT and the author of several books on democracy, power, and economics. So is it Gen Z that is driving these protests?
I think it's the general level of dissatisfaction that's stronger among the youth because they are the ones who are bearing some of the heaviest brunt of economic opportunities dwindling. They are the ones who are most at the front lines of the fear of artificial intelligence taking jobs. And some of it is really, frankly, that democracy has underperformed relative to its promises. Inequality has skyrocketed everywhere. Public services have been in a bad state in many countries. I think they are the ones who are most dissatisfied with current establishment politics, including democratic politics in many nations.
So is that the commonality here, that it is economics and failures of democracy that's bringing people to the streets in these very diverse places from Nepal to Kenya?
I believe that is one of the main driving forces. I don't think that we would be in the present moment had it not been for all of these economic problems. What distinguishes many of these movements is that they are against the establishment, but they're not actually proposing a viable alternative institutional or policy path that would really resolve their problems.
So this is protest without real asks for a concrete alternative? Is that what you're saying?
It is. I would say it is protest without a clear roadmap of how any kind of reform or policies would really deal with the discontent that is fueling the protests.
Hmm. So are there things that you see as an economist looking at these protests that could be changed that would make them more effective? I mean, you're saying that they're not putting out a viable option for change, but do protesters typically do that?
Yeah, you're right, actually. I mean, you can say, why are we holding these protesters to a higher sort of ideal than protesters in the past, which are also often incoherent movements. But I think the problem is, say, for example, if you take protests against military dictatorships in Latin America, or going earlier, you know, protests for women's rights, there were clear steps that establishment could take that would satisfy the protesters. It's not clear in this instance what that would be. For example, in Chile or in the United States or in France with the Yellow Vest movement, what are the policies that would really resolve the main grievance points of the young people who were pouring into the streets? That's very unclear to me. And I think it's unclear to most of them as well, how they can be institutionalized, say, for example, in the form of a labor party or a socialist party or something like that, that would have been in the past a sort of a vehicle for the further advancement of their agenda.
There have been different outcomes from these protests. Can you highlight the places where there has been some change?
I mean, I think in Nepal, we see that the protests, which again had an important social media and Gen Z element, have really started changing politics in a fundamental manner. In Chile, I think they've had some influence on politics, but not in a clear way. In the U.S., you know, you could go back to the Occupy movement, which had very important effects on culture and the language that we use, but didn't really change politics in a fundamental way, except perhaps through the Tea Party, which then merged into the Republican politics and Trump and so on.
What made Nepal different? It seems to be the example that led to concrete outcomes that you have teased out.
Because I think in the Nepalese case, there was indeed a very clearly anti-democratic, anti-liberal regime that could be brought down. You know, you can say the same thing, for example, in the case of Bangladesh, where it wasn't just Gen Z, but the protests did bring down the government and led to a more democratic government. But I think those are developing countries where there were some very clear violations of all sorts of democratic and liberal norms, which is, you know, a little bit harder to sort of pinpoint in the case of, say, Macron's government in France and so on.
So many of these protests are still ongoing around the world. What will you be watching for in 2026 to see how they proceed?
I think the most important thing would be, would any of them coalesce around an agenda that is ambitious enough to really change the dial, but also realistic? For example, policies that would improve educational outcomes or improve how artificial intelligence is integrated into the economy, things like that, that would really have some concrete and doable, feasible implications.
Daron Acemoglu is an economist at MIT.
For decades, Germany's industrial Ruhr Valley has been working hard to wean itself off coal to meet air quality guidelines in the European Union. Last year, for the first time, Germany finally met those guidelines. In the Ruhr Valley, air pollution declined more than anywhere else in Germany in the past 50 years. But it's still the most polluted part of the country, which meant that when the EU updated its air quality standards last year, the area was found to be, once again, out of compliance. Reporter Katie Burke paid a recent visit to the region to see how that's going.
Viewed from the top of a huge coal shaft tower in Bochum, the mostly flat landscape of the Ruhr Valley looks green, dotted with windmills and a couple smokestacks. The tower I'm standing on is inactive, and like many other inactive towers in the region, it once held the pulleys that transported people and materials down to the mines. Those pulleys are still visible, but Hans Mollick, a retired mine worker, says the once industrial landscape has changed since his childhood in the 1960s.
Hat sich viel verändert. Erinnern kann ich mich hier vorne der Bereich.
Mollick explains that there were more mines all over, but not much greenery. And back then, not a single windmill.
Yeah, look around.
Mollick sweeps his hand to indicate the many windmills on the horizon. This region is known as Germany's industrial heart, and what kept it pumping used to be coal. But in 2018, Germany put a stop to coal mining and coal burning in the Ruhr, as in a complete stop. Visitors like me are often surprised how green it is here in the region known for its belching smokestacks, as recently as a decade ago.
100 years of coal production, and if you look on a satellite image, it's f***ing green yet.
That's Tobias Rudolph. He studies the transition after mining at a local technical university. He says the Ruhr was one of the first places to shut down coal mining entirely.
We have one of the strictest mining laws in the world.
Germany isn't just phasing out the use of fossil fuels. It's also requiring companies to take responsibility for damage done.
Rehabilitation is a big thing.
Here's what he means. In Germany, if you dig a hole, you are responsible for that hole for eternity. From a policy standpoint, the environmental consequences of industry can't be ignored by industry without a cost. Rudolph says that dedication to rehabilitation has paid off. You can see that looking at the landscape. Most people here seem to recognize that. You can also see it in people's health. Environmental epidemiologist Barbara Hoffman has been studying that. She's been a key player in advancing the science of how air pollution affects health. She's also lived it. She grew up in the Ruhr in the 1970s.
It was gray. You couldn't really see well, you know, at 12 o'clock during the day.
Her brother had asthma, but he would get relief on vacations. Coming back, it would return.
Inside of this gray-yellow cloud hanging over our home, he started to get trouble breathing again.
In the decades since, studies have shown that closing coal power plants in a community is associated with a reduction of all kinds of serious health issues, including premature births and ER visits. Moving away from coal has vastly and measurably improved health in this region, but air pollution still needs to come down.
You could see that the sky turned blue again. And I think many people just thought the problem is solved. It's blue again now. We're done. Not being aware that we still have all these health effects of air pollution.
That's why the European Union revised its air quality standards last year. According to new requirements, those standards are connected to health outcomes. Specifically, member states have to reduce premature deaths due to air pollution. To do that, Germany needs to address other causes of pollution besides coal. What they have to do now, according to Hoffman, is reduce traffic emissions.
We need to have less traffic, more active transport, like walking, bicycling, and public transport.
That's why they're investing in alternatives to driving. As I experienced firsthand one day in Essen. I'm walking on the bike path towards where I'm staying on the outskirts of Essen. On my walk, I spotted something helpful. Aha, I just found an e-scooter to rent. So I'm very excited about that because then I can get home in about half the time. Starting ride. Oh, it played me a little song. you can get around this huge urban area made up of 11 cities using bike paths, about 840 miles of them. The Regional Planning Association here built these bike paths along former railways that used to serve the mining industry. Public transit is also widely available. The Regional Planning Association here built these bike paths along former railways that used to serve the mining industry. But the move away from fossil fuels in transportation is still a work in progress. They're working now on connecting the cities to one another by making more trains and buses available on the routes between them. They're also changing roadways to prioritize bikes over cars, because driving is still very much the norm here. When it comes to improving health to meet those new standards, Hoffman envisions a Ruhr Valley where driving isn't common.
I envision lots of great public transport, lots of, you know, very attractive and safe bicycle lanes and nice areas, green areas to walk in. So people enjoy being active outside. You're not sitting in a traffic jam.
So even though the Ruhr has a lot of work ahead to reach the new health benchmark for reducing air pollution by the 2030 deadline, clean air could start paying off much sooner in the form of more days at work, more days at school, and more room to build what comes next. For the World, I'm Katie Burke.
Katie's reporting in Germany was supported by the Commonwealth Fund and the Association of Healthcare Journalists.
In other environmental news out of Europe, lithium is used in batteries that power everything from electric cars to your phone. It's an essential element in today's economy. Europe relies on other places for its lithium, but there is a push to change that by ramping up domestic production. The largest lithium reserves on the continent are in Serbia's Jadar Valley. As we hear from DW's Guy Delaney, local opposition is a force to reckon with, even for the international mining giant Rio Tinto.
Electric cars are quiet and clean compared to their counterparts with internal combustion engines, and ideal for a car sharing service, which makes them even greener. But for power, they rely on the white stuff. That's the lithium that goes into electric vehicle batteries. And one of the world's biggest mining companies says it's identified a massive reserve of it in Serbia's Jadar Valley.
It's the largest, longest life, highest grade lithium deposit, and it also comes with boric acid.
Chad Blewett is the managing director for the mining giant Rio Tinto's Jadar project.
For Europe, where I think over 90% of the refined lithium comes from China, there's a Critical Raw Materials Act that was released last year, and it aims to reduce dependency above 65% from a critical raw material from a single source. So the Jadar project offers two critical raw materials on the EU's list, which is lithium carbonate. Everyone talks about that for batteries. And this project will be enough for 1 million electric vehicle batteries per annum, but also boric acid. For Europe, it reduces the dependency from China for lithium.
How problematic at the moment is it for Europe that it's relying on China for its more than 90% of its lithium supply?
The whole point of the Critical Raw Materials Act is supply chain diversification, strategic autonomy for Europe. And for both Serbia and Europe, with the green transition underway, moving away from fossil fuels for industry, for transport, it's really important to look at renewable energy, storing that renewable energy with lithium batteries.
But the discovery of Serbia's lithium reserves hasn't been greeted with universal delight. In fact, there have been massive protests against the Jadar project. The area is important for both agriculture and sources of drinking water, and environmentalists warn that lithium extraction could damage those equally important resources.
Government tried to hide information. Government tried to push for legislation and strategic document without participation of the public.
Mirko Popovic is from the Renewables and Environmental Regulatory Institute, a Serbian campaign group.
We have a conflict between unresolved development dilemma in Serbia, whether we will provide protection for water, soil and air, or we will do everything we can to extract mineral resources that we have. And this dilemma is not resolved in a way that we have a public consensus. On the other hand, it is strange that the project is planned to be implemented on agricultural land.
The anti-lithium mining protests were so fierce that Serbia's government withdrew Rio Tinto's permits 3 years ago. But last year, the country's constitutional court reversed that decision. Within days, Serbia's president, Germany's chancellor, and the European Commission signed an agreement on access to lithium from Jadar. And in June this year, Brussels designated Rio Tinto's plans a strategic project under the EU Critical Raw Materials Act. Serbia's energy and mining minister is Dubravka Djedovic Handanovic.
We have also started the process of amending our law on mining that would be in line with the new directive of the EU, but that will also protect interests of Serbia and the Serbian citizens when it comes to exploration of those materials. And this includes also the environmental and social standards that need to be applied. And by closely working with the EU, we believe that it is the best partner because, of course, of the high environmental standards that are applied when it comes to developing the mines in the EU.
Now, though, dissent of a different kind appears to have derailed Rio Tinto's plans. Anti-corruption protests have dominated the past year in Serbia. That's dampened enthusiasm among international investors. And the fractious mood has played a part in delaying the government's granting of an official green light to Rio Tinto. There'll be little sympathy from the protesters, but it's ironic that the very resource that Europe needs for its green transition is so close at hand, and yet, still, apparently, so far away. Guy Delaunay, Belgrade.
That story comes to us from our partners at the DW program Inside Europe. Listen to more of their work where you get your podcasts.
Holidays give us plenty of time with our families, people we love, people who also drive us crazy. This story from our archives is a perfect example of that dynamic, showing how one woman ended up on a hilarious global travel misadventure because her family pushed her into it. Geraldine Buckley remembered the saga on GBH's storytelling program, Stories from the Stage.
I was terrified. Absolutely terrified. It was the late 70s. I was 18, standing by the side of a road in Canada, a long way from home. I was wearing a blue circular uncrushable skirt and holding a sign that said, "The border." I was about to put my thumb out and hitchhike for the very first time. And that's why I was so terrified. Now you might be asking, how did I get myself in such a predicament? Well, I blame the whole thing on my mother. You see, my mother had a great love of adventure, but when she was 14 and growing up in Liverpool, the Second World War broke out, and England stayed at war until she was 20. So she said her best adventuring years were swallowed up by bombs and fear and rationing. So she was determined to relive them now vicariously through me. So while other mothers were urging their only daughters to read, to study, to go to college, my mother was saying to me, "For goodness sake, Geraldine, you study far too hard. Put away those books and go out and party." In fact, I'm the only person I know who got a master's degree out of sheer rebellion. So when I was 18, I told her that I was going to go to the Olympic Games in Montreal with my boyfriend. And then we were going to hitchhike from Montreal to New York and fly back to England from there. Well, on that occasion, I wanted my mother to be like other mothers. I wanted her to forbid me to go so I wouldn't have to, and I could tell her she'd ruin my life. But this was my mother, and she said, "Darling, let me help you pack." So that's how I found myself by the side of a road in Canada with my thumb out and my knees shaking. But at least I had my boyfriend standing next to me. He'll keep me safe, I thought. My boyfriend, Ivor, was very respectable. He was 5 years older than me. He traveled extensively, so he explained the rules of the road. Geraldine, he said, you always wear good clothes. That way you get a better class of ride. You never get in a vehicle where you're outnumbered. And when you're in that vehicle, you always chat to the driver to build up a rapport. And if you do those things, you're less likely to be murdered. Murdered? I have a vivid imagination. And I could just see my murdered, mutilated body being tossed out of a car on the outskirts of some exotic American city like Akron. I pray, Lord, please watch over me. And then I wanted to thank every car that whizzed past. But finally, an ancient two-door rusted old Chevy skidded to a halt. Now, I could see through the open passenger window that the driver was alone, which was good. But he had long, unkempt hair, a missing front tooth, and dirt etched in the deep lines of his face. And he said, I can take you 40 miles. And Ivor said, thank you, sir, and got in the back seat with the backpacks and whispered to me, you get in the front. You're good at talking. Build a rapport. So despite my misgivings, I had to get in. I reached for the seatbelt. It wasn't there. Oh, it's no use you going for that, said the man. That dropped off months ago. And he started that car. Well, it looked like a rusted out old jalopy, but he had something powerful under that hood because we went from 0 to 80 in seconds. And the man only had one hand on the wheel because with the other, he was chain smoking. And he was lighting the new cigarette with the burning butt of the old one. And he didn't have an ashtray. Well, he didn't actually need an ashtray because right in front of the gear stick, there was a rusted out hole that went down to the road. And that's where he was flicking his ash and the still burning butts of the cigarettes. I was focused on that hole. I was waiting for a spark to hit the engine and the whole car to explode. And I was just thinking, it's all right for my mother, encouraging me to go on this trip, but I bet she's at home now in a nice comfy chair with a cup of tea, which is exactly where I'd like to be. Oh, for a comfy chair and a cup of tea. You see, I never ever thought there'd be so many ways to be killed hitchhiking. And then the man said to me, I've got a glass eye. Would you like to see it? And he took out his eye and he put it on my shoulder. I froze. I didn't want that eye going into my lap or down by the floor. I didn't want the man grabbing for it, particularly not as we were going so fast. And then I slowly turned my head and I wasn't quite sure what to say. I mean, really, what is the protocol? When you're eyeball to eyeball, with an eyeball. So I turned my head a bit further to see what Ivor's reaction was. His eyes were closed. He was taking a nap. I finally managed, that's fascinating. And that seemed to placate the man because he didn't say anything else until he dropped us off about 20 minutes later. But I was very relieved that from that moment onwards, he kept both eyes on the road, even though they were 3 feet apart. I was so glad to get out of that car. I watched it disappear until it was just a speck in the distance. But all that time, I felt that eye, now back in the man's head, staring at me through the rear view mirror. But then I remember something my mother had told me while she was helping me pack. She said, darling, don't worry, I've prayed. So everywhere on this trip, you'll be safe. Because the Lord, he'll keep his eye on you. Thank you.
That's Geraldine Buckley, featured on GBH's storytelling program, Stories from the Stage.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back tomorrow, New Year's Eve, with a holiday special. See you then.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.